From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
We have won the presidential elections, and that data will be confirmed by the Federal Electoral Institute.
Quiero informar al pueblo de México que de acuerdo.
I want to tell the Mexican people that according to our data, we won the presidency of the Republic.
Ganamos la presidencia de la República.
Populist candidate Andrés Manuel López Obrador and conservative Felipe Calderón both claim victory in Mexico's closest ever presidential race. López Obrador is now calling for a full recount after charges of voter fraud and manipulation. We'll go to Mexico City and have a roundtable discussion on the elections. Then troops home fast. Hundreds of people around the country are beginning fast to protest the war in Iraq. We'll speak with an Iraq war vet who was arrested protesting war on July 4th and an Iraqi blogger. Both are participating in the fast. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. A former U.S. soldier has been arrested on charges of raping an Iraqi woman and killing her and three members of her family. The attack took place in the town of Mahmoudia in March. According to prosecutors, former Private First Class Stephen Green broke into the family's home and killed the woman's parents and young sister. Green and another soldier allegedly raped the woman, shot her, and then set her body on fire in an apparent effort to cover up the crime. The woman's name was Abir Qasim Hamza. The military reported her age is 20, but locals say she's 15. Neighbors told investigators Abir Qasim Hamza had expressed concerns to her mother because the soldiers had made advances towards her before. The case marks the fifth in recent weeks in which U.S. troops have been charged with committing atrocities in Iraq. This is Ahmed Hamed, a resident of Baghdad.
It is a heinous act, and Iraqis should stand against it. The Iraqi government should take a clear stand and put an end to the Americans' degrading acts against the Iraqi people.
Four other active soldiers are being held pending the outcome of a military probe. This is U.S. General Peter Pace.
If there are those who have done things as they've been accused of, we will get to the bottom of it. We will do the investigations. We will find out what the truth is. And if necessary, we'll take those who deserve to be taken to court so they can have their day in court.
General Peter Pace is chair of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. In other news from Iraq, the New York Times is reporting U.S. forces plan to bulldoze several blocks in the middle of the city of Ramadi and convert them into a new green zone, similar to the U.S. command area in Baghdad. Lieutenant Colonel Stephen Neary said some of the raised land will be turned into a park. He added, quote, aesthetically, it will be an improvement. The military is engaged in a large-scale operation in Ramadi that's already led to the flight of thousands of residents. According to the New York Times, one poster displayed in the local U.S. base reads, quote, be polite, be professional, and have a plan to kill everyone you meet. Another poster refers to the name of the military unit and says, quote, Kilo Company killed more people than cancer. Meanwhile, officials at Baghdad's central morgue say killings have sharply increased since the death of Abu Musab al-Zarqawi. More than 1,500 bodies were delivered last month, a 16% increase over the month before. Meanwhile, United Press International is reporting delivery of dead bodies is so high the morgue has run out of adequate space to store them. On Saturday, 66 people were killed and more than 100 injured when a truck bomb hit a crowded market in Baghdad. It was the deadliest attack since Iraq's new government took office in May. North Korea has test-fired seven missiles in the last day. The test's one long-range missile reportedly failed within a minute into the flight. The test marked North Korea's first since it launched a medium-range missile over Japan 8 years ago. Emergency meetings will be held in Japan, Korea, as well as the United Nations later today. In Mexico, the party of the populist candidate Andrés Manuel López Obrador is demanding a full vote-by-vote recount in the country's closest-ever presidential race. A preliminary count of the votes cast in Sunday's election gave a slim lead to conservative candidate Felipe Calderón. But federal election officials acknowledged Tuesday more than 3 million ballots, or 8% of the total, remain uncounted. In the latest tally, Calderon leads Lopez Obrador by under 1 percentage point, meaning the race is still too close to call. We'll have more on Mexico after headlines. But in other news from Mexico, former President Luis Echeverria has been placed under house arrest on accusations he ordered government forces to open fire on student protesters nearly 40 years ago. On Friday, a judge ruled there's sufficient evidence for the former Mexican president to stand trial on a charge of genocide. The killings occurred October 2, 1968, 10 days before the Olympic Games opened in Mexico. Human rights groups estimate at least 300 people died in the massacre. Israel is escalating the military assault on the Gaza Strip, launched following the recent capture of an Israeli soldier. Earlier tonight, the Palestinian Interior Ministry became the latest target of nightly attacks on Gaza City. The strike set the ministry building on fire and caused damage to neighboring apartments. Several people, including four children, were wounded in the attack. Another overnight Israeli strike targeted an empty school in northern Gaza. Meanwhile, militants from the armed wing of Hamas took responsibility for a rocket attack that hit a deserted schoolyard in the Israeli town of Ashkelon. It was the deepest rocket attack inside Israel to date. Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert called the rocket firing a major escalation and ordered troops to move into Palestinian residential areas. Israel says it'll create a security zone to thwart rocket-firing militants. Referring to two northern towns in Gaza, senior Israeli cabinet minister Ziv Boim said, quote, "As far as I'm concerned, the people of Beit Hanun and Beit Lahia can start packing." Israel has been widely criticized for its actions in Gaza. On Monday, the Swedish government said the assault amounted to collective punishment and called for an end to attacks on civilian property. The government's statement follows a warning last week by Amnesty International that the attacks violate international humanitarian law and constitute war crimes. In Denmark, a group of demonstrators marked the 4th of July with a protest against the U.S. prison at Guantanamo Bay. This is an unidentified protester speaking outside the U.S. embassy.
This is a protest against the Guantanamo base. Today we all orange. Today we all prisoners at Guantanamo. This is a birthday card from Copenhagen, Denmark. And we want to tell America that you have to treat these people as humans, give them a fair trial, and close the Guantanamo base. Happy birthday.
In Nepal, the U.S. government is coming under criticism from Maoist rebels who accuse it of undermining the peace process. The Bush administration has said it'll withhold aid if the rebels join the government without first laying down their arms. In intelligence news, the CIA has admitted it has folded the unit tasked with finding Osama bin Laden and his top aides. CIA officials say they made the move because they believe al-Qaeda operations are largely carried out independently of a central command. And this news on Cuba. The Independent of London is reporting a new report from a State Department group will urge the Bush administration to begin preparing for an intervention in the event of the death of President Fidel Castro. The group, the Commission for Assistance to a Free Cuba, was created by President Bush 3 years ago. Their recommendations include creating an $80 million fund to promote U.S. initiatives in Cuba. An annex to the report lists several proposals on how the Bush administration could undermine Castro's government. Cuban parliamentarian Ricardo Alarcón likened the report to a declaration of war. And in Connecticut, Senator Joseph Lieberman has announced he will run as an independent if he loses next month's Democratic primary. Lieberman is in a tight race with challenger Ned Lamont. His popularity has waned among Democrats over his support for the Iraq War and other policies backed by President Bush. Lieberman's campaign has begun collecting signatures towards putting him on the ballot as an independent in the event he loses the race. In a statement, Democratic Senator Hillary Clinton of New York said she hopes Lieberman wins the race, but will support the nominee chosen by Democratic voters. On Tuesday, Lieberman was heckled as he took part in an Independence Day parade in Connecticut. One group of demonstrators carried two giant papier-mâché heads of Lieberman locking lips with President Bush. Lieberman dismissed the protesters, calling them, quote, a distant minority. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The party of populist candidate Andrés Manuel López Obrador is demanding a full vote-by-vote recount in Mexico's closest ever presidential race. A preliminary count of the votes cast in Sunday's election gives a slim lead to the conservative candidate Felipe Calderón. But federal election officials acknowledged Tuesday more than 3 million ballots, 8% of the total, remain uncounted. In the latest tally, Calderón leads López Obrador by just over 0.6 percentage points, meaning the race is still too close to call. On election night, both of Mexico's major television networks said their exit polls showed a statistical tie. 2 hours later, both candidates claimed victory. This is López Obrador speaking in Mexico City.
Quiero informar al pueblo de México que de acuerdo...
I want to tell the Mexican people that according to our data, we won the presidency of the republic.
Ganamos la presidencia de la república.
Felipe Calderón also claimed victory on Sunday night.
We have won the presidential elections, and that data will be confirmed by the Federal Electoral Institute.
The new election results were released on Tuesday after López Obrador made charges of fraud and manipulation of the vote. His party is calling for a full recount of all 41 million votes, claiming that some voting places were counted twice while others weren't counted at all. Although a formal recount will begin today, electoral authorities will only be required to recheck tallies from each ballot box. López Obrador has been running on a progressive platform calling for greater aid to the poor, free medical care, and food subsidies for the elderly, the rewriting of NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement, and the end to the further privatization of the country's oil and gas industries. Meanwhile, Felipe Calderón has received the strong backing of the business community. We're joined now in our Firehouse studio by David Brooks, the U.S. bureau chief for the Mexican daily newspaper La Jornada. On the phone from Mexico, we're joined by Gilberto López Rivas. He's with the National Institute of Anthropology and History in Mexico City, frequent contributor to La Jornada. We're also joined on the line by John Ross, a journalist and author who's written 3 books chronicling the Zapatista movement in Mexico. His latest book is called Making Another World Possible, Zapatista Chronicle 2000-2006. And we're joined by Professor George Grayson, a professor of government at the College of William and Mary. He also writes regular column and a weekly magazine, Forum Weekly magazine in Mexico. We welcome you all to Democracy Now! David Brooks, let's begin with you. Were you surprised by the vote?
The election had been neck and neck for the last couple months, although López Obrador's people had expected to win by 2, 3, 4 percentage points. So everybody was a bit upset about this tie. And the question is now that nobody quite knows what the result is in Mexico. And that uncertainty and that doubt that has been brought upon the electoral institution for not being clear about what happened with these 3 million votes, what's happened with the preliminary results, has led for more uncertainty. And so now we're in uncharted terrain in Mexico.
George Grayson, you're with the College of William and Mary, a professor who writes a weekly column in Mexico. Can you talk about your reaction to the vote?
I agree with David. I was out on election day as an observer visiting various precincts, and I found it to be a relatively calm, orderly process, except their so-called special precincts, casillas especiales, where if you happen to be a tourist from another part of Mexico, you can cast your vote. Regrettably, the election law only allows these special precincts to have 750 ballots. And I was in the neighborhood of the Basilica of the Virgin of Guadalupe, where there are just thousands and thousands of tourists on the weekend. And in the 5 special precincts around the Basilica, or in that particular borough of the city, all of them ran out of ballots, and they were looking for another place to vote. I think that was probably more bureaucratic incompetence and the failure of the legislature here to update a law that's about 11 years old. But otherwise, the voting seemed to go smoothly.
John Ross, you've been writing extensively, well, for years and in the lead up to the election and now afterwards. Your assessment today of what the numbers mean that have so far been revealed and how this reverberates with the past.
I think I'd like first to say that we need to put this in context. This is the most important election that Mexico has had, perhaps since the Mexican Revolution. This is an election which will tell us whether Mexico is part of North America or is, in fact, in alignment with the left democracies in Latin America that have developed. This is an election that's been based on the class war. López Obrador represents the poor people in this country. This is poor versus rich, brown versus white, worker versus boss. This is, in fact, an electoral class war, and, in fact, if the election isn't straightened out real quickly, it's not only going to be an electoral class war. My assessment is that, in relation to what Professor Grayson said, that you can't tell anything from what happens in the polls on election day. Elections here are stolen before, during, and after the election. And so now we're in the aftermath. And we saw the disappearance of 3 million votes from the prep, from the preliminary totals. Only 2.5 million have been put back in there. There's still 600,000 votes out there. I personally believe that that those votes were not counted on Sunday night to give the impression that Felipe Calderon had won the election. The prep, of course, can't determine who won the election, but if we look at the news media, particularly New York Times, Washington Post, LA Times, they're all giving it to Calderon on the basis of this prep, from which the Federal Electoral Institute withdrew 3 million votes in order to give the impression that Calderon had won. And I think that's a measure of how the Federal Electoral Institute has acted throughout this entire electoral process, way before the campaigns began in January, when Luis Carlos Ugalde was appointed president of the IFE. We began to see a pronounced bias against Andrés Manuel López Obrador and in favor of Felipe Calderon and the decisions that the IFE and Ugalde were making. This latest event where 3 million votes disappeared and then were placed back in after Ugalde was called on it, and he only on a television interview yesterday morning admitted that these votes had been taken out. The other thing, Amy, that we really have to look at is that there's an enormous disparity between the numbers of votes that have been cast for senators and deputies and those for the president. And interestingly enough, in those states in which the PRD, Andrés Manuel López Obrador's party, has won the election, there are many fewer votes for the president than there are for the senators and deputies, whereas in the states that the PAN now controls, there are many more votes for the president than there are for the senators and the deputies. And the state that's most, I think, glaring here is the state of Tabasco. 13%, there are 13% lower votes for the president than there are for senators and congressmen. And I say that Tabasco is an interesting case because both the candidate from the PRI, Roberto Madrazo, and Andrés Manuel López Obrador are natives of Tabasco. And of course there would be a much higher vote for president than there would be for senators or deputies. So that's where we are today. They begin to tally up the districts. There's going to be a huge fight about whether or not you get to open up the ballot box, open up the bags in which the ballots are counted, and recount those things. What we're seeing here is a replay of the 1988 election, which was stolen from Cuauhtémoc Cárdenas by an electoral authority that was then part of the government. The IFE is supposed to be autonomous, but we're seeing a replay right down to the fact that on Saturday night, two poll watchers were shot. Were killed. After the 1988 election that was stolen from Cárdenas, hundreds and hundreds of his supporters were killed in political violence here.
Your response, Professor George Grayson, you too are in Mexico City right now.
Oh, I think it's been a public relations nightmare for the Federal Electoral Institute because López Obrador was asserting that there were several million votes that hadn't been tallied. And the head of the institute did recognize that yesterday. I think it's too early to say that the fix is in. And one of the problems was when they constituted the Political Council of IFE, which, as John Ross said so accurately, supervises the election, issues credentials, and gives a preliminary tally. López Obrador's party wasn't included on that nine-member council. And I think it was a mistake by the main political forces here not to just lock the various party leaders in a room and insist that they have someone from López Obrador's party. Now, his party can be feisty, sometimes downright cantankerous, but it was a major error, I think, of Congress and of the government secretary not to include his party in the race. Before we get to the point of painting him as some kind of a Franklin Roosevelt, I wrote a book about him that was published 2 months ago. It followed him for 3 years and went to his hometown of Tepititan in rural Tabasco. And I think he's done a service to the nation in that he's focused on the plight of the poor here, because about 10% of the elite control 45% of the wealth. And it's especially these disparities are especially notable in the South. And if you look at a map of the vote on Sunday, it's virtually the North versus the South, the North being the more developed, the more U.S.-oriented part of the country, the South being less developed, lots of natural resources, but maldistribution of income and larger indigenous populations. But López Obrador, for his genuine commitment to poor people, does have messianic tendencies. He would lead marches from Tabasco to Mexico City, which he called Exodus marches. When he became mayor of Mexico City, he rechristened the city of hope, La Ciudad de la Esperanza. He calls himself the little ray of hope. And during his first 3 years as mayor, he regularly distorted or perverted actions of the city council. They passed a bill, for example, requiring all motorists to have auto insurance. He simply told the Secretary of Transportation not to enforce that. The city council passed legislation saying we want a transparency council so we can have a local Freedom of Information Act. He tied that initiative up in knots, and so it now has become a toothless tabby cat. So he has a strong commitment to the poor, but he also has a belief that law is the will of the people, not actions of elected officials.
And, Professor George Grayson, we'll get response after break. Professor Grayson speaking to us from Mexico City. John Ross, also there, independent journalist David Brooks in studio here in New York of La Jornada, Mexican newspaper. When we come back, we'll also speak to Gilberto López y Rivas, who is an anthropologist in Mexico City. Stay with us. Sierra Madre by Tuxedo Moon here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. As we talk about the elections right now in Mexico, the PRD candidate, López Obrador, has called for a recount, with the officials saying it's too close to call, though many are calling it for the PAN candidate. And we have a roundtable of people to speak, in addition to John Ross, independent journalist in Mexico City. We're speaking with Professor Grayson there, David Brooks of La Jornada in our New York studio, and we're now joined by Gilberto López Rivas, anthropologist with the National Institute of Anthropology and History in Mexico City. Can you first share your reaction to this election? They say the closest in history, and this latest news of the 3 million votes that have not yet been counted.
Well, I think that we have the phantom of the fraud election and stay election appearing now in the public opinion, and letters. Hundreds of letters in the electronic means of communication are counting the irregularities and the forms in which this fraud is carried on by the own Institute of Federal Elections. And I think that the counting of the votes could clear the this fraud, or could confirm that there is a complicity between Ugalde, who is the head of the Institute of Federal Election, and the president Fox. So now we have, as the other professor said, a nation divided by the vote, but united in the clarification process that is needed to accept any president in the future. So I think that we are in the middle of a big conflict that is going to explode in these days. The counting is, it has to finish at the end of the week, but I think that the people is not so happy with what is happening now.
In terms of history, going back to Cuauhtémoc Cárdenas, 1988, afterwards there was terrible violence. A number of people were killed, López Obrador being one of the top aides to Cárdenas at the time. Do you see this being repeated today?
Yes, but with the difference that we have a society more more clear, with more consciousness of what is happening, and if we have a modernization of fraud by the means of the electronic counting, we have also the democratization of what is happening by the means of the electronic mail. So what is happening now is that I receive hundreds of mails that are calling to demonstrations. As a matter of fact, today we have several demonstrations in front of the electoral body counting. So I think that the society, Mexican society, cannot afford another fraud, and especially with this officially difference that today appear in only 0.63% of difference between one and the other candidate. So I think that there are more forces, political and social forces, that are going to oppose to this kind of results.
The Los Angeles Times is reporting today suspicion among López Obrador's supporters was heightened Monday when the investigative magazine Proceso, citing police intelligence sources, reported that senior Interior Ministry officials had attempted to shape media coverage on election night. Ministry officials called the news directors at Mexico's two leading television networks and requested that they not broadcast the results of their exit polls, Proceso reported. Those exit polls, of course, showing that López Obrador was in the lead.
Yeah, it's completely the behavior of the means of communication, the television especially, is completely in the sight of the government, because we have a legislative reform that gave them the complete monopoly of the means. So I believe that the behavior during the night of the election was completely suspicious, and nobody explained why they don't give the election exit polls that in another occasion was a kind of something natural. And everybody is talking about that there is a big complicity between the big means of the media and the electoral body and the power. So this belief is going into thousands and thousands of citizens that are very, very angry with what is happening. So I think that we are going to have days and weeks and probably months, and I think that we are not going to have a president in the several weeks that is going to be accepted and, for the Mexicans.
David Brooks, can you talk about the role of U.S. consultants in Mexico, specifically Dick Morris?
The campaign of Felipe Calderón became much more successful once it went negative, and it started borrowing U.S.-style fear campaign tactics and negative campaigning. Dick Morris was one of the informal consultants. He claims that he was never hired. It wasn't full-time, but that he has said and admitted that he did have informal consultations with the Calderón campaign.
Now, Dick Morris being the former...
strategist for Bill Clinton, who was then had to leave the public scene in disgrace, and now is a Rupert Murdoch columnist. For Rupert Murdoch Media. Part of what he contributed, as well as what operatives from the Aznar government and the ex-prime minister of Spain, Aznar, and other people to the campaign, was to create a sense of fear about the possibility, because actually projecting López Obrador as a danger to Mexico, as a danger to the United States, as somebody who would be akin to a Hugo Chavez on our border.
Not only akin, I was looking at a magazine from Mexico that had a chessboard with Hugo Chavez and Fidel Castro being the players, and they're holding the pawn, who is López Obrador.
And the campaign also projected him as somebody who violates the law, disregards the laws.
As Professor Grayson
right,
was saying.
And part of that became part of the media campaign of saying this person is dangerous, doesn't respect the law, is willing to go to the streets and provoke violence and confront things. And all this, and during the up to the end of the campaign, people were getting messages on their phones, as well as emails from the Calderón campaign, saying that if López Obrador won, you might lose your car, you might lose your business, and you might lose even the right to practice your Catholic religion. And so it intensified. This did have an effect and did close the polls and did polarize the election. To a point, and that media campaign is now proceeding after the election, where most of Mexico's mainstream media, as well as the two monopoly television stations, have been projecting Calderón and giving a sense that he has won. There is no official result. The Federal Electoral Institute has said that the preliminary vote cannot be an indicator of who won or who lost, et cetera, et cetera. That media campaign has now crossed the border And just yesterday, the LA Times, the Chicago Tribune, the Washington Post all published editorials basically repeating some of the claims of López Obrador as a danger, basically proclaiming that, in their view, Calderón has won the election and saying that that's a good thing for Mexico and for the United States. Because, again, as the LA Times editorial subtitle says, editorial standoff reveals a populist candidate with undemocratic leanings. Why they make this accusation because he proclaimed victory late Sunday night, but they failed to mention that the PAN was the first to claim victory, and that Felipe Calderón, a few minutes after Andrés Manuel said this, he said the same thing. So essentially what we have is this whole media campaign, very similar to what we've seen in this country, where the fight now is to use the media and use as all the tools possible to proclaim yourself a winner without a basis in any of the facts. So what's happening as well, and what I think the key is in Mexico, is not what the fight is between López Obrador and Felipe Calderón, but what about the people? And supposedly they're supposed to be the protagonist of this great democratic expression, and that's what's being violated right now. And that's what the fury is and the ire and the anger of people. Neither of these two candidates can claim to now represent the majority of Mexico. And so one of the questions is how is Mexico going to define how to proceed? And the protagonist can't be the candidates. The protagonist has to be the popular will. At least that's what we're told in a democracy. And the other factor there is, of course, that the U.S. has been very careful, the U.S. government has been very careful not to openly participate in this election, which is the wise thing to do. But it's no secret that the Bush administration, that Wall Street, and, of course, the major media in this country favor Felipe Calderón. And that is also creating an issue of be careful what you read in the editorials, although the reports in most of these papers contradict the editorials. Mm-hmm.
John Ross, from your vantage point in Mexico City and your years of writing on this issue, the Zapatistas, where does the whole movement fit into this? This week, Subcomandante Marcos was in a radio studio also alleging fraud.
I've written a lot on the Zapatistas. The Zapatistas are in the middle of what is called the other campaign. I haven't been real happy with the other campaign, and I think Gilberto is probably a better person to talk about the other campaign than I am. At this particular point, I think that the campaign has it's kind of like a bicycle. When it doesn't go forward, it falls over, and it's kind of fallen over here in Mexico City. It pretty much limited its constituency to many young people, very much out of the mainstream of Mexican politics at this point, and indeed is a contributor to the fact that Andrés Manuel López Obrador has had difficulty here, and there's been constant attacks on him by Subcomandante Marcos since the very beginning of this campaign. I wanted to take up another theme because I think it's important, and also to respond to Professor Gray, who wrote a hit piece, a book that was a hit piece on Andrés Manuel López Obrador. This question of Andrés Manuel López Obrador as being a violator of the law. We see statements in the New York Times by Ginger Thompson that he led violent demonstrations in Tabasco in 1996. I was with López Obrador at those demonstrations in front of the Pemex platforms. They were, in fact, nonviolent demonstrations, just another example of how the U.S. press has turned this thing around. Here in Mexico City, he was accused of breaking the law because he tried to build an access road to a hospital out in Cuajimalpa in the violation of a court order. They tried to bar him from the ballot, the major parties, and Vicente Fox tried to bar him from the ballot. He put 1.2 million people in the streets. I was happy to march in that demonstration, largest political demonstration in Mexico's history last April, and they dropped the charges right away. So the other thing is that, when we say that the media has been very bad in this campaign, we have to understand that they're operating with the permission of the IFE. These hit pieces, spots that ran for months and months that compared Lopez Obrador, intercut his face with Hugo Chavez, Subcomandante Marcos, riots, lynchings, whatever you want, always intercut his face, ran for months and months and months despite the objections of the PRD and of Lopez Obrador. It was only when there was a court order to have them removed that the IFE moved to remove those from the air just at the beginning of June. Time and time again, I think the most egregious, one of the most egregious errors, maybe we can, maybe a deliberate error, that the IFE committed during this campaign was to disenfranchise millions and millions of Mexicans north of the border by setting up a procedure where it was impossible for people, undocumented workers in the United States, to cast a ballot, although there is now a law that says they're allowed to cast that ballot. And it, indeed, on Sunday, when thousands of people caravanned out of Los Angeles down to Tijuana to vote, and the PRD is extremely extremely strong in Los Angeles, they were denied the vote because there were not enough special polling places and because, as Mr. Grayson has indicated, there's only 750 ballots in each. So at every step, and again, but the bulk of those voters, millions of voters in the United States who are thought to be Lopez Obrador supporters, were denied the ballot because of these vague procedures.
Professor Grayson, your response.
You know, first of all, IFE wasn't enthusiastic about having the vote abroad. It was legislation passed by the Mexican Congress, you know, which is elected. And I agree that the Mexican Congress is no model of efficiency. It does much better at blocking bills than passing them. But IFE simply had to abide by the guidelines, and the guidelines required expatriates to have to register in January, and so that meant that you were going to have a very small registration, only about 41,000 sought ballots, and maybe 32,000-33,000 actually voted. Turns out the overwhelming number of people who voted from abroad voted for Calderon, although one can assume that was a middle class, largely middle class vote. With regard to the 1988 election, I was here for that one also, and undoubtedly the fraud was ubiquitous. But there wasn't much violence after that election, mainly because the loser, Cuauhtemoc Cardenas, who's run three times for president of Mexico unsuccessfully, and who's kind of an icon of the Mexican left, and who did not support Lopez Obrador in this campaign. The election was in early July, I think July 6th, as I recall, and about 2 months later, he went into the Zocalo and made a speech in which he criticized the outcome of the election. He said he had been defrauded of the presidency, although, of course, the ballots were impounded and later burned. But he did not call the people to violence. There was a major split within what became the PRD at that time, and Cuauhtemoc Cardenas acted in a patriotic fashion, because you could have had a class warfare at that time. With regard to the spots, the negative campaigning here is really rather mild compared to what it is in the United States. It's just for 71 years, one party controlled the system, and the candidates didn't have to, at least the candidates of the official party, didn't have to beat up on their opponents because they were going to win anyway. And Lopez Obrador does make intemperate statements on the stump.
I'm going to give the last word to Gilberto Lopez Rivas. Your response and final comment.
I agree with a lot of commentaries that are making my colleagues. And what for me is important is what is going to be the reaction of the people before the fraud that is carrying out by the Federal Institute. That is the main question. We have to go into what the people is thinking and what the imaginary of the people is thinking. The Mexico is wasn't a specialist in the electoral fraud, but we believe that we have been years ago. And that is very dangerous today. It's completely dangerous. I think that if the tribunal, the electoral tribunal, that is the body that has to say that who is the next president, doesn't take in account what is happening in the Federal Institute, this is going to be a kind of riot in Mexico.
We'll leave it there, and we'll certainly continue to follow the story of the Mexico elections. I want to thank you, Gilberto Lopez y Rivas, for joining us, anthropologist with the National Institute of Anthropology and History in Mexico City, David Brooks here in New York of La Jornada, John Ross, who writes for The Nation and writes independently a number of books, among them Rebellion from the Roots and the Annexation of Mexico, and Professor George Grayson of the College of William and Mary. I want to thank you all for being with us. Democracy Now! Will continue after break on the fast that is happening all over the country to bring troops home. We'll be speaking with an Iraqi blogger and a U.S. Iraq war vet. Stay with us. Lion by Emmett Rhodes here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman as we turn now to Iraq. On Monday, a former soldier was arrested on charges of raping an Iraqi woman, then killing her and three family members. Prosecutors charged that 4 months ago, Stephen Green walked into a house in the town of Mahmoudiya, killed three family members, and that he and another soldier raped a woman named Abir Hasim Hamza. The age of the rape victim is unclear. The mayor of Mahmoudiya said she was 15. These latest charges come on the heels of a number of investigations into U.S.-led civilian atrocities in Iraq. Meanwhile, thousands of protesters gathered across the country yesterday to protest the ongoing war in Iraq. One of the largest demonstrations took place in Washington, D.C., was organized by Code Pink. Code Pink launched a nationwide fast to demand an end to the war. The fasters will stay in front of the White House every day till August 14th, when they move the hunger strike next to President Bush's vacation ranch in Crawford, Texas. We're joined by two of the fasters now. One is an Iraqi blogger named Raed Jarar, and Jeffrey Millard. He is an Iraq war veteran who served for 13 months in Iraq. He was arrested on July 4th during the protest in Washington, D.C. We welcome you both to Democracy Now!
Thank you.
Let's begin with Raed Jarar. You are an architect. You are well-known as the blogger who runs the blog Raed in the Middle, .blogspot.com. Your response to the news of this latest atrocity in Iraq?
The latest atrocity is one of the crimes that are happening in Iraq. But this one is having a big national coverage now, and it's turning into an Iraqi national crisis because of the significance of it. Yesterday, the Iraqi parliament, one of the Iraqi parliament members, asked the Iraqi parliament to hold an emergency session, and they called the prime minister, Mr. al-Maliki, from his trip to come back home and discuss the issue of the rape. The member of parliament who asked for the session is an Iraqi woman, and she said that raping an Iraqi woman affects all of Iraq's honor, and this is a national problem that should be dealt with very seriously. The Iraqi media and the Arab media are taking this case very seriously, and I think that because the girl, Abir al-Janabi, she belongs to a very big tribe, al-Janabi tribe. It's a tribe with both Sunni and Shia branches in Iraq, and this will have a very strong reaction from her tribe and from the local community all around the country.
Now, this case that took place in March in Mahmoudiya, again, the soldiers, now only one has been charged at this point, Stephen Green, and he was dismissed, the military says, as being somewhat vague about this, but saying because he suffered a personality disorder, but he was picked up in North Carolina, now is being charged in a federal court. The allegations are that they took the three family members, the father, the mother, 7-year-old sister, into one room, that Stephen Green killed them, came out, said, I killed them, and that he and another soldier then raped the young woman, then burned her body to destroy the evidence. What about the other soldiers involved with this? What news do you have of this, Raed Jarar?
I don't have much news about them, but I know that the Iraqi government is asking for an Iraqi investigation for this, which is a very strong Iraqi request. And it goes against the Bremer orders that give U.S. soldiers amnesty inside Iraq, and they can't be prosecuted in Iraqi courts, or they can't be investigated by Iraqi police. So one of the more interesting points, in fact, Amy, is that the family of the girl, the rest of her family, her uncles and other relatives, were informed by the Iraqi police officially that this crime was done by terrorists. And this is one of the reasons why they did not follow up on the crime, because they did not know who committed it. So this, in fact, indicates how many other crimes are happening in Iraq, and they are being blamed on terrorists in the time that maybe other people are committing these crimes, and no one is following up to discover who did them.
I wanted to bring Jeffrey Millard into this conversation, who served 13 months in Iraq. The unit that Stephen Green is a part of, apparently the same unit in which the most recently two U.S. soldiers were abducted and then their bodies found. Can you talk from your perspective as a U.S. soldier who has returned, your reaction to this story?
Well, to be perfectly honest with you, Amy, it's not very shocking to me. It surprises me that most Americans are very surprised by this, in that to the American GI, they are taught from the day that they land in Kuwait and every moment that they move north into Iraq and every moment they're in Iraq, they're taught to dehumanize Iraqi people. This term Haji is very prevalent, and to the Muslim world, the term Haji is actually a term of endearment for those who have completed that pillar of Islam, who have made the Hajj to Mecca. But to the U.S. military, it's a term of dehumanization, one that's used so that the American GI can kill without question, and who can follow an order to kill someone without question, whether it's in a gunfight or any other situation. And so when you have this dehumanization factor, then it continuously will escalate. And to me, when we're not investigating things like checkpoint killings, which happen every single day in Iraq, and this is just the logical outcome of that process escalating.
Were you involved with any of these checkpoint killings? You were where, based in Tikrit?
I was based in Tikrit, and I worked for a general, so most of my time was spent actually going through secret material and putting together informational briefings for my general. I was not direct. There was a checkpoint killing one day that I was not directly involved in the shooting, but that evening I sat in a briefing where that was briefed to a general, and a full bird colonel turned to an entire division staff and said, and I'll abbreviate this because we're on the radio, but said, in this checkpoint killing, an entire family was murdered, a mother, a father, and two young children, a young boy, age of four, and a young girl, age of three, were all killed that day in a car. It was moving very quickly towards a traffic control point, at which time a private pressed the butterfly trigger of his 50 caliber machine gun and killed this whole family. And as this was briefed to the general, a full bird colonel turned around to the division staff and said, and I quote, "If this effing Haji learned to drive, this S wouldn't happen." And never that really was a big turning point for me in realizing what war was truly about, and the fact that this term Haji isn't just a term that grunts use on the ground. It's one that is projected down from the top all the way up in ranks downward upon the average GI.
Who said this?
That came from a colonel, and I don't usually use his name publicly, but it came from a full bird colonel in front of a division level staff.
And the general who was there?
The general that was there was the general who I worked for, which was Brigadier General Sullivan.
And did anyone object to what had happened?
Not at all. Not whatsoever. The whole room kind of nodded in agreement, and the briefing went on. I was really shocked by it. It made a huge impression onto the way that I viewed warfare in general. Before I went to this war, I believed, like many soldiers, in a just war concept, and that you could have a just war, and my experiences in Iraq have made me turn against all war in all forms.
And so you've come back. You are now on port. You are on the fast that began this Independence Day weekend, sponsored by Code Pink, that many people are joining, Troops Home Fast. You were arrested yesterday, Jeffrey?
Yes. I'm a member of Iraq Veterans Against the War, a very large national and now actually international organization of Iraq war veterans and those who have refused to serve in Iraq, and some Afghanistan veterans as well. And we went to protest there with Code Pink, and I noticed that there were a lot of veterans organizations who were represented in the parade, but there were no veterans organizations who were anti-war, though there are a lot of us in existence, Veterans for Peace, Iraq Veterans Against the War, Vietnam Veterans Against the War. So there's a number of anti-war veterans organizations, but we were not permitted to be in the parade, and I thought that to be unfair. So I attempted to walk in the parade as a veteran, and I was picked up and placed on the sidewalk the first time, and the second time I was taken to jail.
Riad Giraud, Iraqi blogger, architect, living now here in this country. What is your response to U.S. soldiers like Jeffrey Millard who come home and then speak out against war?
I had a number of personal relationships with U.S. soldiers even when I was in Iraq. And I don't really see U.S. soldiers as the enemy or a part of the game that we should be fighting against. Most of the U.S. soldiers are victims. They are as victims as Iraqis. So, I'm always ready to work and support their work. And Jeff and the rest of the Iraq veterans against the war are doing a very great job in letting the U.S. public know what exactly is happening in Iraq.
Well, Riad Giraud and Jeffrey Millard, I want to thank you very much for being with us. We will continue to cover Troops Home Fast, the fast that's taking place all over the country to bring the troops home and to end the war. That does it for today's broadcast. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.